but not severely enough to cause travelers to be orphaned. That required intent, focus, and strategy. Taking the astrolabe from her, preventing her from destroying it, that hadn't been enough to orphan her. But something else had. They must have used it. That was the only explanation she could think of. The Thorns had used the astrolabe and irrevocably changed, broken, some event or moment in history. And now she was here, with the Ironwoods. And Nicholas was not. Colors burned beneath her eyelids, blood beat between her ears, a crescendo that broke over her in a frenzy of pain and grief. Mom. She couldn't think about her right now. Ironwood had sworn to kill Rose if Etta didn't return with the astrolabe by his deadline. But she took in a breath. Knowing what she did about her mother now, Etta had to believe, she had to hope, that Rose was alive, that she'd already escaped from wherever the Ironwoods had been holding her. Now it was her turn to do the same. She forced herself to relax the muscles bunching up her shoulders, to breathe the way Alice had told her to when stage fright was at its most crippling. The anxiety, the terror, they were useless to her. She breathed in, out, until they were chased out of her mind, replaced by a floating, graceful measure of notes. The music was soft, serene, filling the shadows in her thoughts with light. Vaughan Williams's The Lark Ascending. Of course. Alice's favorite. The one Etta had played at her instructor's birthday a few months before. Before the Met concert. Before she'd been shot just outside the mouth of the passage. Stop thinking. Just go. Her guard shifted in his chair as she slowly rose, and adjusted his own position with a soft sigh. The book was on the verge of slipping out of his hands, onto his feet. She didn't let herself wonder at how strange that was, that the guard had felt comfortable enough to take off his shoes and curl up with a book. It doesn't matter. There was a literal window of opportunity, and she needed to take it now. Its frame creaked in quiet protest as Etta pushed it open further. She leaned out to assess her options, quickly recoiling back into the room. The moon was high overhead, illuminating the bruised remains of a city. There were no streetlights, save for a few distant lanterns. But Etta had a clear view of the hills that rolled down beneath her window, of slanted, winding streets that disappeared beneath heaping mounds of brick and wood, only to reappear again, scorched. The air held a hint of smoke and salt. An insistent wind carried thick fog up from a distant body of water, as if the city was breathing in the clean, cool mist. Skyscrapers had whole sections of themselves scooped out, their windows knocked loose like teeth. But here and there Etta saw buildings and structures that looked freshly built, all framework and unfinished brick faces. While many streets and patches of ground had been cleared, the sheer scale of the destruction reminded her of what she had seen in wartime London with Nicholas. She had the ghost of an idea where she was, but it fled before she could grab onto it. The when seemed more obvious. The furniture, the expensive draperies and bedding, the hideous Victorian doll-like nightgown someone had stuffed her into. The destruction. Late 19th century. Early 20th. Well, she thought, hoping to prop up her spirits a bit. The only way out is through. She was on the second or third story of a house, though it was difficult to tell by the steep angle of the road below. This side of the house was covered in an intricate puzzle of wood scaffolding that extended from the roof above her to where the long beams were anchored on the ground. She stuck an arm out, testing the distance between her and the nearest support. Her fingers easily folded around the rough wood, and before she could question the decision, before she could consider all the reasons it was a very, very terrible idea, Etta climbed out onto the window frame and swung her legs around first to its ledge, then toward the nearest horizontal plank of scaffolding. "This is insane," she muttered, waiting to make sure the wood could at least hold some of her weight. How many times growing up had she seen news reports of scaffolding collapsing in New York City? 8. Exactly 8. The blood drained from her head all at once, and she was forced to wait, heart beating with impatient rhythm, until her balance steadied again. Etta held her breath, arms trembling from the strain, as she scooted off the window ledge and onto the wood plank in front of her. It didn't so much as groan. There, she thought. Good job. Keep going. In some ways it was like heading down a strangely constructed ladder. Every now and then Etta felt the structure tremble with her added weight, and some gaps between the planks and beams were almost too wide to reach across. But she gained confidence with each step, even as the wind plucked at her back, even as she realized she had no idea where to go once she reached the ground. The bay windows on the floor below were longer and jutted out from the house. More dangerous yet, the glass was glowing, light spilling out onto the scaffolding. Etta crawled forward to peer through her cover of darkness. If the room was occupied, she'd have to move closer to the edge of the scaffolding to avoid being seen by its occupants. But first she wanted to know who exactly was in the building, the enormous house, and why they'd taken her in. The room was larger than the one she'd just climbed out of, and lined with stately dark wood shelves that contained row upon row of books. There was a desk stationed in front of the window, and a large, broad-backed chair turned away from her. But the room was otherwise empty. "Come on," she whispered. "Move it, Spencer." Her lip began to bleed as she dug her teeth into it, trying to keep from crying out in pain each time she dropped down and overextended her hurt shoulder. Gripping the beam she'd been sitting on, as if she were on the monkey bars, she stretched her toes out and felt a tremor of panic deep in her gut as they barely scraped the beam below. Too far. Her arms strained under her weight as she looked to her right, her left, trying to judge how far she'd have to shift and scoot over to reach the nearest vertical support and slide down it. No, she wasn't going to make it, not with her shoulder on fire and her entire body shaking. Not going to make it. She looked down again, this time to the ground below, the slant of the street, and tried not to picture what she'd look like lying there in a broken heap of gauzy white fabric and blood. If she could drop softly enough, she might be able to balance, catch herself. A sudden movement at the window in front of her snapped her attention forward again. A bemused face stared at her through the glass. She blinked rapidly, her breath locked inside her throat. The window creaked open, out toward her.
"Well, that's a bit of trouble you've gotten yourself into, old girl."
Arms reached for her, and Etta didn't think, didn't speak, just kicked. Her heel connected with something hard, and she took some satisfaction in the surprised, "Cripes!" laced with pain in response.
"That was uncalled for," came the same voice,
now muffled as he clutched his nose. The pain in her shoulder and left arm stabbed straight through her fear, and her fingers spasmed and relaxed their grip on the beam. A gasp tore out of her as she dangled there by one arm. Her jagged fingernails dug into the wood as she frantically tried to line up her footing below, before she lost what grip she had.
"Take my hands. Come on, don't be a fool about this," the young man was saying.
Etta leaned back out of his reach, struggling to pull far enough away as he climbed onto the frame.
"Really? You think the better option is breaking your neck? I'm hurt."
The wind picked up, tossing her loose hair into her eyes, lifting the hem of her nightgown.
"I can admire the intent here, but you should know that all it would take is one shout from me and you'll be swarmed by unhappy thorns having to climb down to fetch you. I doubt you want to die either, so let's have it then. I'll help you back inside as easy as pie."
"Thorns?" Etta's brows knitted together. "Not ironwoods?" She didn't recognize the sounds at first, the odd rumbles and creaks, but the vibrations under her hand, those she understood. The whole structure of scaffolding was being shoved to the left by the wind, leaning, until she heard a snap and felt something clip her bad shoulder as it fell behind her. Then she was falling too. 4. It happened too fast for Etta to even scream. One moment she was falling, the next her arm was caught and yanked in its socket as two hands closed around her wrist and dragged her toward the pale exterior of the house. Her cheek slammed against the rough stone, and she squeezed her eyes shut as the scaffolding began to shudder, folding in on itself and collapsing down onto the old-fashioned cars parked on the street below. "Reach up, will you?" the young man said, the words strained. Etta shook her head. Her wounded shoulder was too stiff, and the whole length of it, from neck to fingertip, felt like it was filled with scorching, sun-baked sand. Instead, he released her wrist with one hand and reached down to grab her nightgown. There was a loud grunt overhead as he heaved her up. Etta's feet scrambled against the wall. She didn't breathe again until her elbows were braced on the windowsill. Then she was spilling through it, onto the young man and the carpet below. She rolled off him and onto her back as soon as she landed. Her whole body sang with pain and adrenaline, and it was several long moments before her heart steadied enough for Etta to hear anything over its frantic rhythm.
"Well, that was exciting. I've always wanted to rescue a damsel in distress, and you've given me twice the fun on that front."
Etta cracked open an eye, turning her head toward the voice. Next to her, propped up on his elbow, the young man was making an appraising, appreciative study of her. She pushed herself upright and scooted back against the desk to put some much-needed distance between them. He was young, her age, or a few years older, with short, chestnut-colored dark hair, brightened by streaks of red. It was mussed to the point of standing on end, and Etta had the horrifying realization that she really had gripped it for leverage when she tumbled back into the house. His shirt was open at the collar and inside out, as if he'd picked it up and thrown it on without a second look. He scratched at the shadow of scruff along his jaw, studying her with piercing, light blue eyes that warmed with some unspoken joke. His voice. Those eyes. Ironwood. Etta pulled herself to her feet, but her path was blocked by the desk. He'd claimed they were with the Thorns, which could only be true if he'd defected from Cyrus Ironwood's ranks and joined theirs. Or if he was a prisoner, same as her. Or it would make him a liar. But if this was the truth, then Etta was exactly where she needed to be, with the people who had stolen the astrolabe from her.
"I suppose you gave me a bit of a fright. I can be man enough to admit that."
"Where am I?" she asked, interrupting him. He seemed startled by her ability to speak, but he stood and retrieved a glass of some amber liquid from a corner table for her.
"You sound as terrible as you look, kiddo. Have a sip."
She stared at it.
"Oh, you're no fun," he said with a little pout. "I suppose you'll want water instead. Wait here and be quiet. Can't raise the alarm just yet, can we?"
Etta wasn't sure what that meant, but she complied all the same, watching as the young man walked to the door and stuck his head out into the hall.
"You there! Yes, you! Bring me a glass of water! And don't bloody well spit in it this time. You honestly think I'm not well-versed enough in that fine art, Denosius?"
The response was immediate and irritated.
"Not your damned servant."
So there are guards after all. The only question was whether they were protecting him, or protecting themselves from him.
"I do believe the official decree from your master and commander was, give the dear boy what he wants. This dear boy wants water. And make it snappy. Pep in your step and all that. Thanks, old chum."
Etta's lip curled back, definitely an Ironwood, and by the sound of it, definitely working with the Thorns.
"I'm not your—"
The young man shut the door on the response, and leaned back against it with a pleased little smirk.
"They're such a serious bunch that it's all too easy to rile them up,"
he whispered to her with a wink.
"You and I will have the best fun together now that you're here."
She glared back. Unlikely. After a moment, the door popped open and a hand thrust itself in, with a glass of cloudy-looking water.
The instant the young man took it, the door slammed shut. This time, Etta heard the lock click from the outside.
"You use your old bathwater,"
the young man shouted through the wood.
"You'd be so lucky," came the reply.
He was still muttering as he crossed the room again and handed it to her. It was tinged a putrid brown, with a few suspicious particles floating in it. Seeing her face, he said,
"Sorry. The water situation is none too good after the earthquake, as you can imagine. No one's gotten sick from it."
And then, after she'd already taken a sip, he added,
"Yet."
The water did have an odd taste, a little metallic maybe, a little dirty too. But she downed it in two quick gulps. Her hands and arms were still trembling as they tried to recover from the strain.
"Where am I?" she demanded. "When?"
"San Francisco," he said. "October 12th, 1906. You've been out a number of days."
Etta's heels seemed to sink further into the rug as the weight of his words slammed into her. 13 days. She'd lost 13 days. Nicholas could be anywhere. Sophia could be anywhere. And the astrolabe.
"We were briefly acquainted in the middle of the Texas desert, just after you were spat out by a passage. You might remember."
"Are you looking for a thank you?" Etta asked.
"Don't I deserve one? You were damn lucky we were orphaned through the same passage. I saved you from both the nearby guardian and the coyotes circling nearby, waiting for you to croak. In fact, I'd like to think that if it weren't for me, the boss man would be lowering your tattered remains into the ground."
That confirmed her suspicion, at least. Some change must have been made to the timeline that orphaned all the travelers born after that time. Etta closed her eyes, took a steadying breath through her nose.
"What changed?" "What changed? Oh, you mean the timeline. Judging by the party they neglected to invite me to, the timeline shifted the way they were hoping it would. The dimwits running this joint said something about Russia losing but winning. Drunken nonsense. Why we're still in scenic post-earthquake San Francisco is anyone's guess, though. Stay with these people long enough, though, and believe me, they'll show you the armpit of every century."
"You haven't even tried asking them, have you?" Etta asked, unimpressed. "What year?" His look was slightly scolding.
"I told you, 1906.
She swallowed her noise of irritation. "No, I mean, what year was it in Texas?"
"I'm not entirely sure I should say."
Etta lunged forward, barely catching the words burning the tip of her tongue, before they had the chance to singe him. He wasn't going to keep the last common year from her. That was the only way she could figure out how to retrace her steps to Damascus, and to Palmyra.
"Oh-ho!"
He stood and backed away from her.
"You've got that wild look in your eyes, like you did just before you bopped me on the nose. Believe me, they've removed everything that can be used as a weapon."
Etta looked down at the glass in her hand, then back at him, one brow arching. "I've gotten pretty creative over the past few weeks. I think I can handle one minor ironwood."
"Minor?"
he shot back, his voice wavering between incredulity and outrage.
"Don't you know who I am?"
"No. You were so busy congratulating yourself, you never got around to making introductions," Etta said. "Though I take it you know who I am."
"Everyone knows who you are,"
he muttered, sounding annoyed.
"How far I've fallen that I actually have to introduce myself."
He placed one arm behind his back and the other across his waist, giving her a mocking little bow.
"Julian Ironwood, at your service."
Her disbelief must have been splashed across her face, because his smile shifted, becoming sardonic. Clearly not the reaction he had been expecting. "Julian Ironwood." Etta let out a small, lifeless laugh. Time travel had already presented a number of brain-bending possibilities. Meeting an 18-year-old version of the violin instructor she'd known from the moment she was born, to name only one. But, surprise, experiences like that didn't make it any easier to come face-to-face with the dead. Etta tried to keep her expression neutral, knowing that staring at him in horror was going to raise some flags in his mind. Nicholas had warned her repeatedly about the dangers of telling anyone their fate, that knowing how and when they would die could affect the choices a person made, and potentially the timeline. Alice had given her an out, had specifically asked her not to say. But now... The guilt felt familiar as it pulled in her heart. Etta bit her lip. It was just... What were the chances of meeting Nicholas's brother, and here of all places? And why hadn't Nicholas mentioned that Julian had been held at some point by the Thorns?
Either my adorably sadistic grandfather has done something terrible to you, or you're about to inform me that I've died by, rather stupidly if I say so myself, falling off a mountain, he said. Those seem to be the only two reactions I get these days.
You, Etta sputtered, whirling back around. I didn't mean to, it's just...
Calm down, will you? You're going to give yourself the vapors for no good reason, he said. As you can see, I'm not dead.
Wait, she began, coming closer to better study his face. His eyes were the same icy shade of blue as Cyrus's, and she could detect, under the scruff and grin, the same high cheekbones and long, straight nose that age had tempered on the old man's face. Julian also seemed to have the Ironwood affinity for grappling for control of every conversation, no matter how short. "You're alive," Etta finally managed to get out. You didn't die after all." He grinned, enjoying the conversation, and motioned down to his body.
"Still in one piece. The luck of the devil, as old grandpops used to say. Rather odd, that, considering he is the devil."
"What happened?" she interrupted. He gave her an infuriating grin.
"Tell me what you think happened."
Etta, with patience she had no idea she possessed, managed to tamp down her temper long enough to say, "There was a storm. You slipped on the path leading up to the monastery. Tatsang Palfug."
"Did Grandpops really give the world that much detail?" Julian asked, flattening his hair with his hand. "He's usually so quick to defend the family's honor, but I guess even he couldn't resist making me sound like a right idiot."
There was a sharp undercurrent to the words that seemed at odds with his jocular tone. Etta studied him again, the slouching posture, the unkempt clothes, the glint in his eyes she'd originally taken as mischief, and wondered which side of him was the truth, and which she'd simply made a home in.
"I thought he would have..."
He kept pacing, but this time turned his eyes to the floor.
"Did he... I never heard anything about a memorial or the like."
Etta's brows rose. "I don't know. I'm assuming."
"It's not that it matters to me," he said quickly,
shaping the words in the air with his hands.
"But it's sort of anticlimactic to disappear into a puff of snow and mist. A chap wants to know that... You know, actually it doesn't matter. None of it really matters."
"Stop. Stop pacing. You're making me nervous," Etta said. "Can you stand still for 1 second and actually explain this to me?" He popped himself up onto the corner of the grand desk, folding his hands in his lap. Within seconds his bare feet were swinging, drumming against the leg of it, and Etta realized she'd asked for the impossible. Not only did he not shut up, he couldn't seem to burn off enough energy to stop moving.
"In that instance, the Thorns were also responsible for orphaning me," Julian said. 3 years ago, they used a passage to New York in 1940 to set a fire at the New York World's Fair, hitting at Grandfather's business interests in that period. At the same time, I happened to be stupidly falling down a mountainside in Bhutan. Since I was born in 1941, I was kicked through the passageways to 1939, which was, at that point,
the last common year between the old timeline and the new one, Etta finished. Between tracking the timeline, the collection of years at the mercy of the traveler's actions, and each traveler's personal life that they lived straight through, even when they were jumping between centuries, she thought her brain might explode. "But I was born after 1940, too, and I wasn't orphaned when that change occurred."
"Then the change must have been confined to that year, and not rippled past 1941. I'm sure you've heard this 1,000 times by now,
but you know how the timeline is about inconsistency.
Etta did know. It had self-corrected as if passing over a speed bump, instead of the road completely diverging.
Interesting. At least that time I got spat out in the Maldives, made for quite the vacation. But by the time I located the necessary passages and resurfaced, I caught news of my supposed death, and decided I might as well make the most of it.
And it never occurred to you once over the past few years, that you might, you know, tell someone that you were alive?
Not Nicholas, not Sophia, not any other member of his family.
Julian pushed away from the desk. He moved to the bookshelves, dragging his fingers along the beveled spines of the books as he made his way around the room. It was like watching a cat pace in front of a window, restless and watchful.
If she hadn't heard the words leave Nicholas's mouth, she would never have believed they were related at all. It went beyond their looks, where Nicholas moved in assured, long strides, even when he was uncertain of where he was going. Julian had a kind of agitated undercurrent to his movements. He didn't have Nicholas's height either, and his body hadn't been honed and chafed by the hard work of life on a ship.
Julian's words fell over each other, as if fighting over which got to escape first, while Nicholas took careful measure of each and every word he said, knowing how they might be used against him.
Julian seemed to be bursting at his seams, and Nicholas had been so careful, so steady, in holding his feelings in check.
Because he had to. Because he'd had none of the privileges Julian had, born into a family that never wanted him, and a society that scorned and disrespected him.
Anger bloomed, vivid as the crooked portraits on the wall. If this really was Julian Ironwood, then it was the very same person who had taken advantage of Nicholas's love for him, the one who'd turned around and treated him like little more than a servant, rather than genuinely teach him the ways of travelers.
"I'm the fool," Nicholas had told her, "because in spite of everything, he was my brother. I never saw him as anything else, and it clearly wasn't the same for him." Julian hadn't even had the common decency to find a way to tell his half-brother he was still alive. Instead, he'd let Nicholas drown in his guilt. He had let him spend years questioning his honor and decency. He had let Nicholas take the exile and rage-fueled beating from Ironwood. All of this time, Nicholas had been suffering. And for what?
Nothing. "Well, kiddo, to continue this tale, I floated around for a while, living life as one does, without much money to speak of, which got me into more than a few scrapes. It all became rather tedious and boring. Enter the Thorns. I thought it might be best to sell some knowledge about Grandfather, try to exchange it for steady meals and a safe place to sleep at night."
He glanced at her, as if expecting Etta to coo with sympathy. She kept her gaze on the unlit brass chandelier overhead, fingers curled so tightly around the lip of the desk that her hands prickled with pain.
"Don't do it. He's not worth it."
"Speaking of," Julian said, swinging around toward her, "I'd like to get back to you. Holy God!"
Etta relished the throbbing pain in her knuckles as her fist made contact with his cheek, and he stumbled back over his own feet, landing in an ungraceful heap on his bottom. He stared up at her with huge eyes, one hand still cupping the red mark on his face as she shook out her hand.
"What the bloody hell was that for?" he howled. "Do you have any idea," she said, voice rising with each word, "what your death did to your brother? Do you have any idea what he went through? What your jackass of a grandfather put him through?"
"Brother?" Julian repeated, rather stupidly. Her instinct to give him another kick, this time beneath the belt, must have registered on her face, because Julian scrambled back on the rug.
Then, to her surprise, he said,
"But how do you know Nick?"
Etta studied him. He looked genuinely shocked, either from her hit, Nicholas's name, or both. Unsure of how much information to trust him with, she answered, "I traveled with him for a little bit." His brow creased.
"On behalf of Grandfather?"
She shook her head, but before she could elaborate, a key scraped in the door's lock. It should have been enough to send Etta diving behind the desk, out of sight.
Instead, she stood there, towering over Julian, the door letting out a tortured groan as it was thrown open. Two men barreled in with guns in hand, both dressed in trousers and plain white shirts, coming up short at the sight of her. The one out in front, a dark, bushy mustache disguising half of his face, actually took a generous step back, crossing himself.
"Christ,"
said the other, glancing at the first. He was somewhat shorter, his pale hair cut close to the scalp, and almost gone from balding.
"The others were right. It's the bleeding ghost of Rose Linden."
The other one merely crossed himself.
"Are you supposed to be protecting me?" Julian complained. "This girl is clearly deranged." "Deranged is one word for it," the dark-haired man said.
Now Etta recognized his voice as that of the man who had sparred with Julian over the water.
"How in the hell did you get in here, miss?"
"I think the better question is, why did it take you almost a half hour to realize I was gone?" Etta said, reaching back for the water glass she'd left on the desk. Before either man could answer, she slammed it down on the edge of the desk, shattering its top half and leaving a jagged edge on what was left. For one insane instant, Sophia's lesson on where to cut them, how to slit their throats, floated to the front of her mind. "Get a grip, Etta." She needed to stay here and find the astrolabe, and she wouldn't be able to do that if she was locked away. But part of her hated that these people had seen her at her weakest, her most helpless, and she couldn't ignore it. They needed to know she would fight back if they pushed her.
"Easy there," Julian cried.
He craned his neck up to look at the men.
"Aren't you going to do something?"
The pale-haired man raised his small black pistol, then swore, tucking it back into the waistband of his trousers.
"Come along, girlie. It's time for you to go back up to your room."
Etta swung her makeshift weapon toward him, ignoring the small, warm pool of blood collecting in her palm from where she'd cut herself.
"I don't think so."
Dull footsteps grew to a pounding storm out in the hallway, and the music she'd heard before cut off with a loud scratch. She caught snatches of voices shouting, "She's gone! Find her!" and a variety of swearing that would have made even the men in Nicholas's crew blush.
"She's here," the dark-haired man called. "The office!"
The rush of panicked activity ceased, but one voice rang out.
"Thank you. That'll be all the excitement for this evening, God willing."
The two guards straightened. The smaller of the two even reached out to fix the limp cloth hanging around his neck into something resembling a bow tie. A man strode into the darkened corner of the room, hands tucked into his trouser pockets.
"We were handling the situation, sir,"
the dark-haired one said quickly.
"I was about to return the girl to her quarters."
"I see,"
came the amused response.
"But it seems to me that she's the one who has this situation well in hand."
The man stepped into the shallow firelight, giving Etta her first real glimpse of him. It was the guard from her room. Dark eyes swept around the room, studying each of them in turn. But his gaze lingered on her, so unflinching that it seemed to wipe everyone else away, leaving just the two of them. The man's presence made her blood slow, and finally still in her veins. But the trickle of uneasiness she'd felt at his appearance was nothing compared to the torrent of uneasiness that came in the moment where her memory met recognition. Etta wasn't aware that the glass had slipped from between her fingers until it fell, striking the top of her bare foot, and rolled away. The black hair, cut through with silver strands, his rough-hewn features. She wasn't seeing him in the high-waisted pants or loose white shirt he currently wore. She saw him in a classic black-and-white tuxedo, wearing silver-rimmed glasses, in the grand hall of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, in the 21st century.
"You recognize me,"
he said, with a small, approving note in his voice, like he'd expected she wouldn't. Not only had she bumped into him, he'd come running when she and Sophia had found Alice lying in a pool of her own blood, almost as if he'd known it might happen, or as if he'd been the one to pull the trigger.
The two guards immediately stepped closer to the man's side, as though they'd been drawn into his orbit. He looked to Julian and said, this time with a slight edge,
"How did I know to check this room first?"
"She dropped in on me,"
Julian protested, pointing to the window.
"I was minding my own business, for once."
The man flicked his dark gaze to Etta, and this time she forced herself to meet it. The corners of his mouth tipped up again.
"I don't need to ask how you got in here, for I suspect the mountain of scaffolding piled up outside is likely my answer. Tell me, did it ever occur to you that you could have broken your neck?"
He was so calm, his voice so measured, that he made the rest of them sound manic. Even his posture, the way he hadn't once tensed up, made her want to ruffle his composure, just to see how far he could be pushed, to see where the boundaries of his anger began. It would be useful later, she thought, in trying to trick him into saying something about the astrolabe, and where the thorns might be keeping it.
"You know," Etta said, "you're making me wish I had."
She wiped her slick palms against the horrible nightgown, wary of the man's warm laughter, the spark of enjoyment in his voice. He turned to the bald guard, knocking the back of his hand against the other man's chest.
"I told you she had some spirit, didn't I?" "You did,"
the guard confirmed.
"Sir, I take full responsibility for all of this."
Sir waved his hand before placing it on the guard's shoulder.
"I was there, and slept through her clever escape. Have Winifred dress her and bring her to me once she's comfortable and presentable, will you?" "Yes, of course, sir," the guard said, nearly sagging with relief.
"I'm not going anywhere with you," Etta said, taking a step forward. "I don't even know who you are. What right do you have to order me around?" The man had already begun to turn toward the door, but at her words his shoulders stiffened. He glanced back over his shoulder, but the candlelight flared in his glasses, masking his expression. Julian coughed, either to hide a laugh or his discomfort.
"My name is Henry Hemlock, and you're here at my mercy," the man said. "You will do as I say, because I am your father, and we have much to discuss."
Nassau, 1776. 5. The storm had broken at dawn, bringing a bit of mercy to what had been a night that redefined misery. Nicholas and Sophia trudged and waded through still-flooded streets, following the path of the runoff toward the beach. Servants were waking, appearing on the balconies of bright, two-storied wooden buildings to beat rugs and toss out the waste, and the smell was rank enough to leave him feeling as if the small town had become one large chamber pot. After a rather unfortunate splash of something he didn't care to inspect, Sophia's mood had gone from sour to curdled. They'd spent hours hiding from the tavern owner, though Horsun had sent out a veritable gang of men and redcoats to find someone to hold accountable for the damage the fight had wrought, and had settled on them. This despite his own gleeful participation. The dodging and hiding had considerably hampered their search for the man who'd stolen Rose's letter. As it turned out, even a rare Chinese man in the Indies didn't attract the necessary attention to leave a trail of witnesses behind. Nicholas had caught himself wondering more than once if he'd had more to drink than he thought, and made a man out of a shadow. But the doxies and their customers upstairs had seen him, so surely. He stilled, turning back toward the harbor. Would he make for a ship? If he was an Ironwood, not just some enterprising opportunist looking for possible targets for theft, he'd try to catch the first ship out. The more Nicholas turned over the thought of investigating that area, the sounder it seemed. Information traveled like flies between sailors, and surely someone of the man's ethnicity wouldn't have evaded their notice. Someone might know where he was staying, and if he had any plans of sailing out of port within the next few days. "Damn your eyes, Rose," he thought, not for the first time. "You couldn't have come yourself and saved us the trouble." Sophia had charged forward as his steps slowed. A good three lengths ahead, she turned back.
"Did your mind suddenly go on holiday?" Let's move. I'm ready for this hellish cat-and-mouse game to be over.
You continue on, he told her. I'm going to follow another lead.
No sooner were the words out of his mouth than she came stomping back toward him, sending muddy water shooting up around her already soaking shoes and splattering him in the face.
What lead is this? She pressed. Or have we started redefining lead as wild guess?
He took a deep breath for patience and parceled out his words carefully, so as not to reveal anything she might be able to use herself. It would be like handing her the knife she'd later jam into his spine.
I'm headed to the bay, to see if anyone might have information on our thief.
Fine, she grumbled, turning in that direction. We'll make it quick. He shook his head.
You go back to the beach. Get some rest.
I have to stay, she interrupted, her small pale hands curling at her sides as her stare burned into the side of his face. I have no idea how Lyndon tolerated traveling with you. A few hours into our special partnership, and I wanted to push you out a window. Nicholas was surprised by how hard, how fast, fury gripped him. Exhaustion, hunger, frustration. He could make any excuse he liked. But the truth was, she touched the one sore on his heart that was still raw.
Utter her name again. Test my resolve, ma'am, please.
Sophia glowered. I meant, I don't know how she could stand this game of evasion and stupid masculine pride you seem so fond of. Stay here, go back, don't move, go on ahead. You're not my governess, and I'm not one of the men on your stupid bloody ship. So stop ordering me around. Try to leave me out of this. Try to leave me behind one more time, and I will actually shoot you. In a delicate area.
Do I need to remind you?
He said, hating how quickly she seemed to be able to get his temper rolling on stormy waves.
That you got so deep into your cups last evening that instead of being reasonable and maintaining our disguise, you fired a pistol, and fired it badly inside of a crowded tavern. That just yesterday you harassed and abused a British regular because you disliked the way he looked at you and nearly got us thrown into a rank jail.
Would have been an improvement over where we've been sleeping, she grumbled. She will never respect me, he thought, sick with hate. She will always see me as nothing.
One day they will name a plague for you, he said.
Hopefully a particularly nasty one, she answered. A girl can dream.
From the beginning, you treated me no better than a rat, he continued, ignoring her smirk. Do you want to know how Etta tolerated me? Because we were partners. Because we trusted each other, and because she was capable of taking care of herself. You seem to have appointed yourself to the task of getting us both killed. And while you might consider yourself to be expendable, I need to confirm she survived your treachery.
Nicholas braced himself for her inevitable snide comment, the smirking condensation she seemed to favor. Instead, Sophia busied herself by removing her hat, unknotting the small scrap of leather she'd used to secure her short braid. Her hands worked through her hair, mussing the weave in silence. They fell in line with the men stumbling bleary and beady-eyed out of the inns and taverns, the wreckage of the previous night's frivolities. Some, at least, were making an attempt to tuck their shirts back into their breeches. Still, Nicholas shook his head. Captain Hall would have knocked each of them in turn off his ship if they'd reported back in such a state. Hall. He'd sent word that he was alive and mostly well, but had yet to receive a response. And he likely would not until they returned to port. Nicholas didn't resist the small echo of longing for the thought of boarding a ship and disappearing into the horizon. For the simplicity of that life, and how quickly it would welcome him back. Someone began to whistle, a high, bawdy tavern tune that made the men around him chuckle. All at once, seemingly without him knowing, the port city had shaken off the night. Crimson coats dotted the streets, the prim uniforms and gleaming buttons only looking primmer in contrast to their surroundings. Wagons moaned and rattled with the weight of cargo being drawn up and down the path, coming or going, just like the residents of the island. The green palms and underbrush looked as if they had been painted by the sun, glowing with pleasure in the heat, the way they only did after a hearty storm. The old fort stood above it all like a four-pointed star to the west, high walls winking as the light glanced off its wet gray stones.
"Just go," Sophia said, nodding toward the ships in the bay. "You want an out? You've got 2, 3, 4 chances out there."
"What are you on about?"
he asked, batting away how bloody unnerving it was that she'd traced his line of thought.
"Are you still drunk?"
"Only observant," she sang.
"Whatever you think you know, I assure you you do not."
"I know you've wasted our time here. I know you don't truly care about the astrolabe. Just the first girl who turned her big blue doe eyes on you."
"That's not true," he insisted. "And can a deer even have blue eyes?"
"Then what are we still doing here?" Sophia challenged, hands planted on her hips. "Are you hoping that if we wait long enough, the woman might find her daughter and bring her to you? We don't need information about the last common year. It's irrelevant. If the Thorns have the astrolabe, they're traveling with it, and finding them is our best bet for finding it. But you haven't even considered that, have you?"
He was tired. So tired of the Ironwoods, of travelers, of all the meddling in the lives of innocent people, and the hardship they suffered over the greed and demands of his kind. He was inclined to say Ironwood could take the blasted astrolabe to hell with him, if it weren't for the damage he knew Ironwood could do to Nicholas's own time.
"I made a promise," was all he said.
"Promises are for saints and losers. Most of the time we can't even keep the ones we make to ourselves."
He gave her a sour look from beneath the brim of his hat.
"You and I are entirely different people."
"You don't say," Sophia scoffed. "At least be man enough to admit that what you really, truly want is to find Etta."
"More than my next heartbeat."
But it was like swimming out to sea in the rain. No matter where he went, he could not avoid the cold drench of truth. Etta would want him to finish what they'd begun by finding the astrolabe. And leave her to die. His right hand curled at his side, and he could almost catch the memory of what it had felt like to have her hand tucked there. And that was it. That calm certainty in knowing her as he knew himself. There was no point to any of this if Etta didn't survive. The future didn't belong to him. It had belonged to her, and had always been tied to her dreams. He wanted that success and celebration for her. The chance for her to resolve the unfinished yearnings in her heart. Everything good in his life was her, or meant for her. At the time, it had felt like an inevitability that they would collide, even in the face of such insurmountable odds. Each time something had blocked their path, it had only served to feed that necessity of staying together. Now and then, though, when he stared into the fire at night, or stole a moment to himself, a passing doubt caught him in its snare. They were both so very, very stubborn, so determined to strike back at the rules of life, the way their situation had confined him, that he worried they had only come together purely as an act of rebellion. But then her face would find him, as fierce as the moment he'd first clapped eyes on her. When his hands were dry and chapped, he recalled the softness of her skin. When the world shivered at the approaching winter, he recalled the warmth of being beside her. When he felt the sneering judgment of the eyes around him, he recalled the invincibility she instilled in him with her belief. And the doubts, they would recede as quietly as they came, leaving a peace as vast as the deep, dark ocean. Nicholas believed they could find that place she had spoken of, the time that was meant for the two of them. He had to believe that. It was weeks since she'd been orphaned. If she had survived her wound and found help, as he hoped she had, Etta was strong enough to keep surviving and begin finding her way back to Damascus. Perhaps they'd meet each other halfway and continue what they'd begun, rewrite the rules of this life. Sophia pressed on.
"Go find her. Sail off into your sunset and leave me to..."
"To?"
he prompted when she did not continue, already knowing the answer. "Leave me to find the astrolabe alone." Oh, He stifled the bitter laugh before it could emerge. She would cherish the opportunity to remove him from the playing field, to not have any obstruction between her and whatever she was planning. Instead of answering, Sophia turned her gaze back out to the tents and stalls, and argued.
"What about Rose Linden's promise to meet you here? Aren't you sick of sitting here and twiddling your thumbs, waiting for Mummy to tell us what to do? If you want us to find Etta, if that will perk you up and get you back on the trail of finding the astrolabe, then we'll start looking for her. It'll be a risk, knowing Grandfather could get to those thorns first. But I guess we'll have to take it. The price we pay for you being so revoltingly lovesick."
He studied her carefully, frowning. Being compassionate was at odds with her natural disposition, and she was so entirely resistant to niceties that he couldn't stop the trickle of suspicion inside him, that she was arguing this point for more than what she was letting him see.
"He doesn't necessarily know what happened," Nicholas started.
"Don't be ridiculous. By now he knows what's happened. We have the small advantage of him being more interested in finding those thorns than us, and we need to use it. So, tick-tock. Let's go."
As loath as he was to concede it, she did have a point. Over the last few days, it had become clear to him that he was the only one willing to play this game with any decency. And he'd begun to wonder if decency was merely the trade of fools.
"Where do we begin to look for her?" Nicholas heard himself ask. "How do we go about ascertaining the last common year without turning to another traveler?"
Any Ironwood or Ironwood ally would immediately report them to the old man for the reward. Without Rose's information, searching for Etta would feel like a dead reckoning. He did not enjoy navigating a ship blindly, and the same could be said of his life.
"We go find Remus and Fitzhugh Jacaranda, like I've been telling you," Sophia said. "Grandfather gave them the worst posting imaginable when they came crawling back into the fold after they betrayed him and joined the Thorns. I would bet anything there's no love lost between them and Grandfather, and they might be willing to share what they know for a price. Or you can just tell them your tragic tale. Let slip a manly, heroic tear."
Pity. Wonderful. His patience finally slipped its leash.
"If they have such a terrible remote posting, who's to say they'll even have heard about the shift in the timeline?"
"If they haven't heard anything, they'll be able to point us to someone who might know. It won't be a wasted trip either way."
Nicholas released a harsh breath through his nose, considering this. Sophia, possibly for the first time in her life, was being reasonable. They were losing time. He was bloody well tired of Rose's games. If the Jacarandas could aid in making quick work of finding Etta, then that was the way forward. If they couldn't help him, at least he could console himself with the knowledge that he was actually moving forward, that he'd broken out of the jail of inaction in which Rose had locked him.
"All right," he said, relenting. "We will try it your way, then. If nothing comes of searching for Etta, then we'll proceed with finding the astrolabe on our own. I promise you."
Sophia rolled her eyes, moving ahead of him again.
"Saints and losers, remember?"
And if Sophia truly was after the astrolabe for her own gain, as he was now doubly certain, then their weak truce would conclude, and he would do anything in his power to keep it from her. Anything necessary.
"Being good on your word is a core tenet of honor," he called.
"Honor?"
She looked disgusted.
"Good thing I don't have much of the stuff left."
Noon arrived, bringing with it a miserable heat that sagged against him, and seemed unjust for October. They passed their walk back to the camp in blessed silence, Sophia stalking forward, Nicholas staying several steps behind. Not just because he didn't want to encourage any words between them, but because he knew that the white men and women they passed would expect it of a servant, a slave. Nicholas shook his head, rolled his shoulders back, as if he could fling it off. The charade sapped what little good mood he'd managed to eke out of the day, and an hour later, when they finally reached the deserted stretch of beach where they'd set up camp, the last lingering traces of goodwill between them evaporated altogether.
Bloody hell,
Sophia snarled, and would have charged forward had Nicholas not gripped her by the collar of her tattered coat. Their blankets had been carelessly thrown around, and the hammocks they'd stretched between palm trees had been dug up and left in tangled heaps. Their single cooking pot, the one he'd disguised among the lush greenery to collect rainwater, had been overturned, thereby catching nothing that they could boil and drink. But it hadn't been the storm that had turned the earth over and washed up what was left of their possessions for anyone to steal. It was a small figure sitting cross-legged in front of the rain-filled fire pit, eating the last few pieces of their jerky, playing with a light Sophia had insisted on bringing, despite the fact that it wouldn't be invented until the next century.
"Drop that at once, sir," Nicholas demanded.
The small man looked up, a piece of jerky dangling from his lips. His dark eyes were strikingly distinct. Two thick, dark brows were angled over them, as if someone had taken ink and thumbed the shapes across. A surprisingly delicate nose and high cheekbones were sunburned, the only flaw in otherwise clear, fair skin. His mouth stretched into a shameless smile around the jerky clenched between his teeth. A weathered navy coat rustled as he brought a gloved hand up, fingers dancing in a little wave.
Thief.
6. It was several outraged moments before Nicholas was able to collect himself enough to speak.
"What is your name, sir? And what business do you have with us?"
The man cocked his head to the side, studying him. After a moment he answered, his voice higher than Nicholas might have expected, speaking a language he'd never heard before. The grating laughter, however, did not need translation. Sophia answered, barking out a string of words in that same language, wiping the gleaming humor from the thief's face. Nicholas released the grip he'd maintained on her coat, and watched as Sophia lunged toward the small man. He rolled back off the fallen palm tree he'd been perched on, dancing away from her reach again and again. After everything she'd imbibed last night, he suspected Sophia had a headache pounding like the drums of hell, so frankly he didn't blame her for reaching into her coat for her pistol and taking aim. The small man froze. Nicholas caught a glint of gold tucked into his belt. A knife, perhaps? The ceasefire, at least, gave him a moment to assess the risk. The man wore the attire of an Englishman, but the loose fabric of his shirt sleeves and breeches had been rolled and tucked at the ends to account for his diminutive stature.
"Put the flintlock down, Nushen," the man said.
Sophia lunged toward him, snarling. In two fluid moves, the man had Sophia disarmed and on her knees on the ground, looking stunned. She growled and, undeterred, rose just enough to try to knock the man's feet out from under him. He simply leaped back out of the way. Something in the man's face shifted, a feminine softening that arrived with a flurry of delighted, girlish laughter. Sophia seemed to realize their mistake the precise moment Nicholas did, and cut off her next attack, stiffening. Not a man. A woman. Nicholas cocked his head to the side, studying the thief again. He could see it now, of course, how blind and presumptuous he'd been. But the three crowns had been dark and his glimpse fleeting. The binding of linen wrapped around her chest peeked out from beneath the loose collar of her shirt. Her focus shifted off Sophia's face to meet his.
"Remove your gaze, ghoul, or I will remove your eyes."
"I know better than that," he said, holding his own pistol steady. "I want the letter you stole."
"Neither of your weapons are loaded,"
the young woman said, flicking her fingers in their direction.
"They are too light in your hands. Neither of you can carry a powder flask. And,"
she spared a glance around their pitiful campsite,
"could you afford such?"
"More than one way to use a gun," Nicholas noted. "Would you like to discover how many?"
At that, a small smile curled her rosebud lips.
"I suspect I know far more than you, Ben Dunn."
He tried to quell the tightening in his guts at the knife-like edge to her words.
"Who are you?"
Sophia managed to get out from between her gritted teeth. The young woman removed her hat, dropping it to the sand with a look of disgust. She lifted her long black braid from where she had tucked it under her cloak, and then a heavy jade pendant, the length of one of Nicholas's fingers. The image of the tree carved into it looked like an evergreen. It stood tall,